of green, red roses too.
This is Ed Cohen, broadcast host on GlobalRadioTalkShow.com, a global broadcast service of Global HR News and GlobalBusinessNews.net. Our audience, according to Google Analytics, is global. However, 60% from U.S. and the Toronto area, about 20% across Europe, about 15% Asia-Pacific, including India and Singapore and Australia and Northeast Asia, and Japan, Korea, Taiwan, and about 4% in Latin America, 1% across the Middle East and Africa. Our guest today is very special, Mr. Paul Falcone. He's Chief Human Resources Officer at the Motion Picture and Television Fund, and that is MPTF.com. MPTF supports the entertainment industry community in living and aging well with dignity and purpose and in helping each other in times of need. Mr. Paul Falcone is a highly accomplished HR exec with extensive and highly progressive experience delivering value-added services in extremely fast-paced, dynamic organizations that are undergoing tremendous change and growth. Paul Falcone has had extensive experience in entertainment, healthcare, biotech, financial services, including international nonprofit and union environments. He's an accomplished author, for sure, and we're going to talk about that. He's a bestseller with HarperCollins, Amicon, and Shurm as an author and a top-rated presenter as well. He's a regular contributor to the HR Magazine and a long-term adjunct faculty member in UCLA's Extension School of Business and Management. In the past, Paul has been head of HR for Nickelodeon, head of international HR Paramount Pictures, and VP HR for NBC Universal. So let's stop with this and get to Paul. He has a lot more interesting things to say than I do. Let's welcome Paul Falcone.
Thank you. Oh, keep going. I love hearing the background.
Well, I'll get back to that.
Okay, that's right.
Okay.
Enough.
So four of your books have been recognized as number one bestsellers on Amazon in their respective categories, and that is truly cool. One of them, I'm just going to read this for a second, 96 great interview questions to ask before you hire, 101 tough conversations to have with employees, and we're going to get into that, 101 sample write-ups for documenting employee performance problems, and more. So, Paul, why is communication so hard in the workplace? It sounds like it should be so simple.
I always say, Ed, that the path of least resistance is avoidance, and people just don't want to dig in. It's just really hard for people. Some are a little shy. Some fear the confrontation. Some fear that if you talk about something, it's just going to make it 10 times worse. And the logic is, as much as an inside HR guy, I've encouraged managers to have these discussions with their employees. A lot of times they're like, well, you don't know what it's like. You live in your HR ivory tower. I have to work with him every day, or I have to work with her every day, and I don't want to open up the can of worms. And so begins the degradation of the relationship. It does. And little things are not addressed. And then the resentment starts to kick in. And then people overinflate the grades when they give them performance reviews and say they're stellar when they're really not. And life is easier. It all goes back to what we learned in the fourth grade. It's not what you say, but it's how you say it. And if you can say it in a constructive way, people will typically respond in kind.
So a part of the issue, I would guess, now I'm an outsider, but I would think part of the issue is how frequent do you engage with the people? Because if it's infrequent, then this will be really hard. Why is this so hard? Is it the numbers game? Is there too many direct reports?
I don't think so. I think that's a cop-out. I think employers have to build relationships with their employees. And too many times, it's easier to kind of keep that distance. Now, what happens is we hire in our own image, and the people that you like, it's very easy to develop a relationship with. Really, a lot of times, it's the people that don't really fit in. It's the ones who kind of separate themselves from the group. Either it's the time clock mentality, or they build them in foxhole themselves. And it's not just a matter of, as a leader, it's your relationship with that person, yes. But it's also how that in person impacts the energy of the whole team. And when the whole team is walking on eggshells around one person, it's very difficult to manage and grow your team and get them performing well. So I wouldn't use the cop-out that there's too many people. I think to your point, communication has to be ongoing and regular, but you also have to discipline yourself as a leader to be able to talk about these uncomfortable situations. And I think that's really what distinguishes a really strong leader from someone who maybe is not that strong in the field. The big three will always be leadership number one, communication number two, and team building number three. And the communication piece kind of links it all together. So you've got to get stronger with that. And the whole idea of writing the book on 101 Tough Conversations was to give them scripts so that they can kind of get a feel before the talk, so to speak, how they might phrase it themselves and what they can expect in the typical employee's answer.
So I want to jump in and ask something that may seem obvious, but perhaps it needs to be addressed. I'm going to assume that the employee wants to change if there is something wrong, rather than just collect a paycheck. So am I on track here or am I off base?
80% of the time, I would agree with you. People don't come to work hoping they're going to mess up. But what you'll see a lot of times is that sometimes the relationship does get beyond the point of really good faith anymore. They just don't trust each other. And it's like, do you like your boss as one phase? Do you respect your boss as the second phase? But the third and the ultimate question is, do you trust your boss? And if the employee sits back and says, I do not trust my boss, that relationship is destined for breach. It is not going to work. So one of the things you talk about when you're holding tough conversations or when you're building a book on how to document problems in the workplace is, of course, you're extending an olive branch. But look, I don't look in people's hearts. I can't know if the manager is well-intentioned as well. And sometimes managers really are so done with an employee that they really don't want to see it get better. They're just looking for the person to go away. So in there is a balance. Yes, you're trying to get the best out of the person and you're assuming good intentions. Yet at the same time, Ed, there are some situations where it's just not working and some people are looking for a lawsuit and this becomes reality too. So you have to know how to protect the company. It's both on the motivation side and getting the best out of people, but also legally protecting your organization, insulating it from liability that is inherent in the employment relationship.
So we have confrontation, we have disagreements. So they're two different things, aren't they?
Correct. One doesn't have to lead to the other. Disagreement is fine. Confrontation is optional.
So I want to just go back to the three things: leadership, communication, team building. It just seems so obvious, but in a work environment and time pressure, I would guess these things get pushed aside because it's not what's necessary right in front of them that moment. Is that correct?
Yeah, I would totally agree with that, Ed. And we don't teach enough of this stuff in school. I mean, you can get an MBA from a top school, and they're not teaching the how. They teach you the what. You understand what the organization needs to continue to thrive functionally and by discipline and business relationships, et cetera, but they don't teach you how to build loyalty, how to build trust with your employees, how to become someone's favorite boss. It's not rocket science, but even when, as an HR guy, when I'm coaching leaders, one of my questions is, and I tell them this one-on-one, and they do not have to answer it in front of me because I don't want to embarrass them, but the question is, would you want to work for you? And the eyeballs go up to the left and they say, well, yeah, I don't know, Paul, no one's ever asked me. I mean, sometimes I think I would. And they laugh a little bit because everyone knows, look, you're not perfect and I'm not perfect. And I wouldn't say I'm the best boss on the planet. But the reality becomes, you know, bosses that are good natural people builders. They're good communicators. They're inclusive in their approach. This stuff isn't rocket science. And part of it is how you built. This is true, right? But part of it is learnable. That's why there's so many books that exists or webinars or whatever, shows just like yours that can talk about how do you move people from this to that. It's not that hard, but they do need the tools. And if you understand that path of least resistance is avoidance and confrontation is not where people want to go, there's a way you can do this respectfully. I'm not saying you're Mr. Nice Guy all the time, but I'm saying you can do it respectfully, but still hold people accountable. And it's the accountability that needs to go. It's not what I see too many times in 25 years of being in HR, where the managers are cutting a wide swath around the employee, the coworkers are cutting a wide swath around this particular employee, and the tail wags the dog. And it's like, how do you get on top of a situation like that? The idea of whether it's this book or any other is you need a handy guide and a guide in hand. You need a consultant in a box that can help you walk through this so that depending on the situation, you can figure out how do I want to say it based on the suggested script. And what can I expect the in-person to say back? And the funny thing is, after doing this for 25 years, people are people. I've done this in entertainment. I've done it in healthcare, biotech. I've done it in financial services. People are people. And I think it's reasonable to say that most people will respond in a particular way depending on A, what they're told, and more importantly, B, how they're told it. You can certainly soften the way you tell it to them while still holding them accountable for increasing their awareness of how they're coming across to other people, increasing their performance and productivity or quality, or whatever else it happens to be.
So now I just want to jump aside here and just make sure that it's clear to the audience that in your role as quite senior, you don't have direct, and please correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm assuming that you and presuming that you do not have direct contact with employees. You have a relationship with senior managers.
Good question, Ed. Actually, it's both. Because employees are oftentimes encouraged to come to human resources when they've got a problem they can't seem to solve with their manager. So when an employee comes in to me, sure, I'm going to help them in any way I can. But I always let them know up front that, well, it depends what it is. I mean, if it's an issue where they want some career coaching and they want to keep it confidential, I can help with that. If it's an issue where they say, I feel like I'm being harassed and discriminated against, I tell them right up front before they say anything. If it has to do with those things, I cannot keep it confidential. I've got an affirmative obligation to disclose this. You tell me. It's the same as telling the management, the CEO of our company. So I want to let them keep those things in mind. But no, my job through all my HR roles has been dealing both directly with other managers' employees and dealing with the managers themselves, oftentimes trying to bring the two sides together to kind of help them reset some structure in the relationship, more direction, guidance, and feedback, and setting them off on a new path so that they can be successful again. It's kind of like a spinal adjustment when you go to a chiropractor. Sometimes they just need a little bit of a tweak in terms of how they're doing things and how they're relating to one another, and you can help turn that around.
In my own experience, I hated some of my bosses, but I loved the ownership, the image, and the brand, but I couldn't stand the supervisor. And so I either got fired or I quit. I don't remember now. And I'm sure that goes on, though.
Oh, no, of course. And Ed, that's kind of the norm. And it's like, look, if you're fortunate enough in your career, for me, by the time I've been around, you know, 25 years in business or whatever, do I have one or two favorite bosses? Yes, I do. And thank goodness at the time I had them, I was fortunate enough to realize how much I truly love these people. And you talk about taking a bullet for your boss and all this other kind of stuff. That exists. Have I had some people who I would be like, I just don't relate to these people. They're not my kind of person. I don't believe philosophically what they believe, and they're really not very nice. Of course, I've had that too. No one gets through a career without having those kinds of things. But my point, I guess, is this. As an employee, you need to learn to manage up better. Everyone does. There is some element of training the boss. It's not like, well, just because the boss is the boss, he or she gets to have their way all the time. You definitely can influence how they manage you. And so the funny thing is, with my books, a lot of times, yeah, the HR people buy it, and the frontline operational leaders are interested in the content, as are the GMs and the company owners. But a lot of times, it's like individuals looking for self-development tools and career growth. It's like, you know, I want to know how to do this more effectively, because when I move into management and I move into leadership, I want to be armed with knowing how to address these things appropriately, professionally, but also in a way that kind of keeps it objective and doesn't have that subjective feel of what I've always say, I'm more about the what so than I am the so what. And what I mean by that is what so is objective. I can talk about that as a manager. I can talk about my perception of it. No one's going to tell me, no, Paul, you have no right to feel that way. As soon as you talk about the so what, though, then it becomes, why did you do that? What were you thinking? I mean, really, seriously? And then you start having that conversation and become very defensive, as with any one of us. So how you phrase the question, how you open the conversation, as long as you're keeping it objective, as long as you can come literally from a coaching standpoint, even when disciplining or even terminating an employee, people respond differently. The lawsuit is the ultimate tool of workplace revenge. You know, they feel like they've been stripped of their dignity and humiliated when they were most vulnerable. You put people in that situation, you're going to have a lot of post-termination litigation. They're going straight to the lawyer because they feel like, really? Okay, well, I'll show you. Let people exit on their own terms. Make sure that they realize it's not about them personally. Sometimes it's just not a good fit. I thank you for everything you've done. I'm sorry that this didn't work out for us. I hope you can respect our decision that we need to move in another direction. But it's time. And that final written warning that we gave you last month, this incident that we just talked to you about that happened last night, it violates the terms of the final written warning. So I'm afraid we're going to have to part ways. But I'm here if I can help you with your resume. If you have any questions about unemployment, you just let me know what you need and I'll be here for you. you have that kind of termination discussion with an employee, and they can go away and they can find peace with it and they can move on. No, they're not totally happy, but at least they feel like they were treated well. And that's really the key to all this stuff. Too much drama, too much excess, you know, you're fired. That's Hollywood. That doesn't happen. I've never used those words in 25 years of doing this stuff. I would never treat someone like that. So again, it's about respect in the workplace, no matter how confrontational or how negative the event that you happen to be talking about.
Interesting. So may I ask you about performance management? Not necessarily how to, but the impact of technology and the younger generation, and of course, multi-generations now in the workforce. But let's just talk about the younger generation who are tech trained, as opposed to me, who wasn't or didn't accept it at the time. But the people who are, you know, they have a job to do. And so how do you advise managers to coach or mentor the people who are on assignment or on a project rather than wait till things go bad? You know, how do you stay in touch, engage, I guess is the right word? Is it through machines or is there a form to fill out or is it weekly telephone call?
So the answer is it can be a little bit of all of it, but no, I typically tell people don't start relying on machines, not an app. You're talking about relationships here. And the funny thing, Ed, is, you know, the younger generation is kind of known for its isolation. If these kids grew up on social media, they break up with their girlfriends and boyfriends texting, not in the workplace. Everyone's got to learn those social skills. Leadership does not come from an app. You cannot outsource it. You can't automate it. This is about building relationships with people. Strong leaders are good relationship builders. Even if you're not someone who prides themselves on being a great relationship builder, you still have to have the reputation for you're honest, you're ethical, you're consistent in what you do, you're fair. When it comes to a discrimination lawsuit, it's the same thing as unfairness. Unfairness is discrimination if it happens to someone who's in a protected category. Basically, everybody's protected these days in one form or another. So you can see where perceptions of unfairness and inconsistency create claims of discrimination that could end up in litigation down the road. So again, when you're talking about how to be a coach to someone, there's so many opportunities. You just got to keep feeding it to your management. This is a quick example. Once you hire them, that's fine, but you need to meet with them for 30 days in and ask them, I recommend about 6 questions. Okay, here's 6 questions to ask. Fine, but at 60 days, you need to meet with them again. Ask a different set of 6 questions and do it again at 90 days. By that time, you've kind of gotten this rhythm down of now you can start doing every 90 days, you just check in. And people, the managers always tell me, they resist it. Paul, I don't need to. I see him all the time. I talk to him all the time. And I tell them that's a different conversation. What you're talking about on the shop floor is different than when you're sitting with someone in a quarterly review. You don't have to do any work as a manager. Just give them the form to give you updates. Where are they in terms of what's going on in their world? How are they doing as far as if you set goals together? You know, how are they doing with their goals? Any roadblocks? Are they getting there? Where are they at? Where do they need your help? Constantly put yourself into a role of career mentor and coach. Get them used to that rhythm. When people feel that, that's the bond. That's the glue that bonds someone to a boss. When you think of who your favorite boss was, oftentimes people respond as, well, my favorite boss, yeah, he always had my back. She challenged me to do things I never thought I can do. She always made me feel inclusive. You're describing the person's beingness, Ed, not their doingness. We all get lost in our society. What are you doing? What are you doing? Always that sense of you have to be doing things to keep people engaged and motivated and cut down on turnover. That's not true. That's a fallacy. Your best boss you will always describe in terms of that person's beingness. It's their character. It's who they were. It's how they cared about you. That's what keeps someone staying with the same boss. No one describes their favorite boss as, oh, you should have seen every Friday morning he brought in bagels for everyone. That's not it. And so the reality is we need to kind of change our sponsoring thought about what it means to be a great leader. And it's easier than we think. We just kind of need to refocus away from what you're doing to who you are, and the rest of it kind of takes care of itself and falls in place.
I want to extend this a little bit out to the aspect and the element of a relocation. People who go out from, say, headquarters out into the field, whether it's across borders, across cultures, time zones, or whether it's from LA to Denver. When people go out on assignment, they are more or less operating on their own. But, and please correct me here if I'm going off on tangent here or I've got it wrong. But how do you stay in touch with people? How do you manage people from afar? And how do you coach. How do you use the skills that they're developing from the assignment and succession plan their next role in order to retain the talent that you do want? I know there's a lot of things I just said there, but is it different than managing in-house as opposed to managing people who are out of sight?
Yeah, it's a big difference. And the thing that I headed up international HR at one point in my career, I was responsible for getting the visas to get the people into the country, handling the expats who were leaving the country. And it's a whole different bailiwick there. But the bottom line, the main issue is you need more structure, direction, and feedback, not less. Because people will naturally feel very isolated. And think about it. If you move to a place where you don't even speak the language, you can't even go downstairs to the store and get a bologna sandwich without needing a translator. It's tough. And so I think the idea would be use the Skype if you have it or whatever so you can see it, but build in these weekly meetings. It's important that you do these touch bases. Too many times I see teams that are fairly dysfunctional, and one of the first questions I ask is, do you hold weekly meetings? And the answer almost always is, nope, don't need to do that. We only get together when we need to. And it's like, now you're missing the point. A weekly meeting with a group plays a very different role. It's a different dynamic. It gives people an opportunity to stand up and take the leadership role on a rotational basis. It gives people a chance to talk to their peers about what they're working on and where they need help. Okay, when you have a one-on-one situation with someone who's now an expat and they're living in China, they have to feel that connection to the mothership. If they feel like they're out there alone on an island and they don't feel like they're talking to their boss on a regular basis, that becomes a real problem. Now, you'll know in the relationship when you can kick off the training wheels, there may be a point 3-6 months out where it's like, we don't need to do these things every week. Maybe we'll do them every other week or even every 30 days. But what my advice always is it's more communication than less when you're dealing with remote workers, because it's too easy for them to get off the track and kind of lose perspective and lose focus. That requirement, that particular kind of relationship has a broader requirement than when you have the luxury of having them in the next office down the hallway.
So to what extent do you get involved with an employee's private life? Let's say they're having marital problem because of work, or particularly if they're on, you know, an international assignment and the spouse hates it.
Yeah, that's real. That's very true. Well, one of the things I would say is most organizations that have international operations have an international EAP, an employee assistance provider, that can help. The company pays a fee for the EAP service, and then the employees can reach out to the EAP counselors for free, and it's part of the employee benefit program. At least initially it's free, and it could turn into something longer term where there's insurance involved and whatnot. But the bottom line is, as an employer, it's a really fine line. You've got to be careful. I don't want to get too close into, I couldn't sleep last night because I had a fight with my spouse. That's too much. And even when it comes to people with medical issues or depression issues, I don't want to know, because then I'm burdened with ADA responsibilities. The ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, says if I know of someone to be, for example, disabled or not able to perform an essential function of their job because of a mental incapacity, way too much drama. So what I've said to people is, listen, I care, but I'm not your best resource. I know you're going through this stuff, and you know I want to help you on the business-related stuff, but for personal, we do have a benefit that will allow you to talk to someone about this, but it really probably shouldn't be me. And let me give you the contact for our EAP provider. Here's the 800 number. Here's who you can speak with, and why don't you give them a call? And it politely takes you out of the middle of that personal conversation, but still gives them a resource so they can work with a professional who's more skilled in that particular area.
Okay. And so the EAP, that's a big umbrella under which there could be many, many things. So the one of the products that came to my attention was a company, I'm not going to mention the name, but it's an online contact for mental health. Not necessarily people going crazy, but just being upset or being stressed out, and it's impacting their lives. But this is really not part of EAP, although I guess it could be.
EAP does everything from financial services help. I need help with a legal matter. I have depression. I have alcoholism in my family. I mean, it's everything. I'm having a problem with my boss. So the EAP services really developed to a point where they want to be a one-stop shop to capture so many things that could be plaguing an employee at any given time, physical or mental or family.
Now, I'm not being political here, but that's a social work issue, right? Social taking care of people, right?
Yeah, Yeah, I would think, oh, listen, the truth of the matter is all of us go through things in our lives. And if, as a company, you can give them a resource, EAPs are not particularly expensive. It's not a Cadillac kind of benefit. And a lot of companies use them, even if you just have 25 employees locally in your particular city. Having that benefit is a great resource. They charge by the number of heads they cover. So if it's a smaller company, it's not going to be too expensive. Yeah, though, I think the idea of happy cows produce more milk, you know, you want to make sure you're taking care of a holistic employee. It's not just performance at work. It's, listen, if they're having problems, either I can accommodate it somehow or help them through it because I'm a good human being and a good person, or if I can't get too involved or I don't know much about it, I'm going to give them a professional resource that they can turn to. The whole idea of employers paying for EAPs is so that employees can take care of personal matters on the side and it doesn't bleed into the workplace and their performance remains at a higher level.
I mean, this is obvious and I'm in complete sympathy, but talking and communications is not a soft skill. It's the basic skill, isn't it?
I think so. But what, you know what you're finding at when I was kind of growing up in business in the early 90s and into the late 90s and into the 2000s, it's like, you know, the soft skill stuff was kind of poo-pooed. Oh, you're HR, that's soft skill. Well, I'll tell you, everything you see right now is soft skills are it. Any leader you ask, any CEO survey that they do, they're looking for strong communicators, excellent leaders, great team builders, turnaround experts. And turnaround just doesn't mean turning around the operations P&L. It means turning around flagging teams that aren't performing well. These soft skills, especially in an environment where automation is taking over digital everything, the people relationship piece, you need very strong leaders in this because you don't have layers and layers of people. It's much thinner, and there's a lot of changes happening. But just check your most recent CEO surveys of what are the most important characteristics that they see in their people. You Google it, and you'll find that communication is pretty much right at the top of the list these days. It's no longer a nice to have. Nowadays, it's really considered critical, which is why you're seeing so many books being published on it, so many talk shows, so many webinars, and the like.
Is this the leadership wisdom you want to leave behind here?
You know, it kind of is. There's so many different ways to do this right. And I think we all do get lost in the burnout and the volume because it's crazy. I mean, truthfully, since 2008, the Great Recession, it's never been the same. And the pace is only going faster. But the truth of the matter is, becoming the best boss you can be is something worth striving for. I mean, if you're a good coach and you're a motivator and you're a people developer, it doesn't matter what the challenges are that are coming your company's way or that your industry is facing right now. Work is morphing tremendously. People are frightened. You know, we're going through what was an industrial revolution in the late 19th century is now a digital revolution in the early 21st. These are big, big changes. But the truth of the matter is, keep it simple. Would you want to work for you? What are three adjectives you think people use to describe you when you're not there? How do you become someone's favorite boss? What does that mean to you? Who is your favorite boss, and how can you pay it forward and become that to someone else? You get your managers thinking about those questions, and what you're going to find is you can turn around the culture. But it has to be caring. It has to be real. This isn't makeup stuff. This is really getting behind their hearts as well as their minds. And you can get over the fear of change that comes, and you can get over the mentality of entitlement that exists in a lot of companies. You can sleep better at night because you're not worried about the legal concerns, because you're insulating your company, you're mitigating damage, because you're smart enough to know that if a person says this, I've got to escalate it. I'll be careful about pre-taliation, which is the idea of employees launching a preemptive strike against you. You're going after them based on performance. They sneak behind your back and go to HR, and they say you're harassing and discriminating against them. All of a sudden, you're on the sharp end of the investigation spear, and it's like, that's not what it was meant to be. There's all these different ways, Ed, that you can do this easily, but you gotta, you know, when they say common sense isn't so common, it's not that it's not common, it's just it's not taught. It's not brought to people's awareness. And I think sometimes people learn more from stories than they do from rules. You tell them a rule, it goes in one ear and out the other. You tell them a story and they can relate to it and the eyeballs go up to the left. And now they start filtering what you said through their own experience and they can make it their own. And so I think it is easier than you think to strengthen the muscle of your frontline leadership. And if you can focus on doing that, then all the cows are happier and producing more milk because the frontline leadership is more aligned. So yeah, the coach, the motivator, the people developer, that's the message if I had to boil it down to one thing.
As we come to a closure, I want to ask you about multi-generations in the workforce, multi-cultures. So how would you recommend teams break down barriers of communication? Do you have lunches or breakfasts with sushi and bagels and, you know, different kinds of foods representing cultures? How do you get it going?
Yes, and people do that. That's an excellent suggestion. And they say, you know, depending on what your ethnic background is or where your great-grandparents came from, bring in something. And I think that's a nice idea. But I'll tell you what my short answer on that is. As a society, we've lost the ability to sit around the campfire. It used to be that the model was that the elders passed on the wisdom to the younger generation. We sat around and we talked. That has been replaced over the last decades by television and social media and whatnot. We need to sit and talk. And I think that piece is what gets lost in the workplace. A lot of my message in the companies where I've worked is, let me sit down with you as the frontline operational leaders and show you what this looks like so that you can go back and do this with your teams. I do think that's critical, Ed. We're not doing enough of that. And you know, the funny thing is, it doesn't matter what the difference is. It's an age difference, a gender difference, a sexual orientation difference. It doesn't matter. People are people. Yeah, the kids of today have different ideals and goals of what they want to be than the people who are getting near retirement. But so did those people when they were younger. That whole idea of bringing in fresh energy is the change. That keeps things healthy. Incorporating the two is a little more difficult when you've got four generations that are still in the workplace. It's the first time we've ever faced this because people are working so much longer. This is a great thing, but it requires a little bit extra effort. So I do think that finding those ways to find the differences and sitting around and talking about this stuff is really the most important.
So the Generation Z, the 22, 23-year-olds who are just entering the workforce, they grew up on Facebook and, of course, chat and social media. And generally speaking, they don't want to talk to people. So how do you deal with this? How do you break the ice? How do you get them to want to talk to people, especially from different cultures and different generations?
What a wonderful question, and probably a book on its own. And the funny thing, Ed, where I work right now, Motion Picture and Television Fund, primarily is a retirement home for people in the entertainment industry. And you talk about, are people feeling isolated or are they lonely when you talk about senior citizens? The funny thing is, as the scientists are looking into this, the most isolated group is not the retirees, it's the kids, it's the Gen Z, because these kids are growing up on social media to the point where they don't talk as much to other human beings, and they have to learn how to do that, and they're not quite there. So I don't technically have an answer for that in the sense where it's still too new a problem. The kids are still too young, and I'm not seeing it enough. I mean, I don't hire a lot of 20-year-olds where I work, but the point is still well taken. And I do think the only solution to this is going to be, as a work society, we're going to have to teach the kids the skills. When I grew up, you watch a TV show like Leave It to Beaver, and when Eddie Haskell wanted to call Wally, he would call on the home phone. Mrs. Cleaver would pick it up. And he'd say, "Hi, Mrs. Cleaver. This is Eddie Haskell. Can I talk to Wally?" And it was great. But yes, Eddie, how's your family? And that was all part of the social fabric. Today, it's direct to cell phones. It's texting even rather than talking. The kids don't even talk as much as they type. How do you kind of incorporate that into the workplace and change their expectations? Because the truth of the matter is you better know how to do that, because these kids are going to need to learn these skills. And if you don't teach them and you don't pay it forward, they're going to have problems in their careers. Now, granted, at some point we'll all be dinosaurs and these kids will be in the CEO suite. But what I'm saying is the communication skills are still so important, and I don't have an answer. I think sitting around the campfire and holding more staff meetings is one of the answers. But getting this entire generation to come away from their cell phone and looking down and looking at people in the eye and teaching them how to address peers and as they move into management, how to address their subordinates is going to be something we all have to keep our eyes on. We're going to see where that leads us. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, I think that you ought to suggest to Tom Hanks that he has to do a movie like Sleepless in Seattle or something like that that portrays this kind of situations, and then the kids will see it, right?
You know, that seems to be the medium that gets their attention, doesn't it? A good old movie like that will kind of get them talking about it, which you're right. I think that's really, it's going to be interesting. These are interesting times. There's a lot of movement going on so many different fronts right now, and we'll see where it leads us, but it's good that we have you leading the Global HR News, and I'll keep trying to write books, so we'll get ahead of the curve if we can.
All right, we're talking with Paul Falcone, Chief Human Resources Officer at the Motion Picture and Television Fund in L.A., of course. So, Paul, can people contact you on LinkedIn or some other way?
Oh, absolutely, Ed. I have a website at paulfalconehr.com, which would make sense since I'm an HR guy. LinkedIn, I would love to get an invitation on LinkedIn, so anyone who'd like to connect, feel free.
Okay, thanks. All right, thank you, Paul, and we'll be back to you soon. Thanks for being our guest on globalradiotalkshow.com. This is Ed Cohen signing off from San Diego, and that was Paul Falcone signing off from L.A. Okay, cheers.
I think to myself, what a wonderful